Welcome to Curated Conversations from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, bringing you the best events each week from the world's number one defense and national security think tank. To explore the hundreds of events we host each year, visit us at csis.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to CSIS. I'm John Alterman. I'm a senior vice president here and director of the Middle East program. And I'm really delighted to welcome you here to this talk about trends in humanitarian assistance. Last August, I went to the UNHCR Refugee Processing Center in Amman, Jordan. It was an amazing place. There are people from all over the world helping these refugees. It was an incredible dedication. And as we went from room to room and from trailer to trailer through the child care center and through these benches of people, I thought two things. The first was, this is just like the Department of Motor Vehicles. People are sitting and waiting for hours, often to do something fairly simple and straightforward. Their faces look sort of blank. But the second thing I thought is how this isn't like the DMV at all. So many of these people came here with their entire families. They've been through unspeakable tragedy, and the stakes are so high. They've lost so much. They have so little control over their lives or their future. I saw hundreds of people that day, maybe 1,000. And that scene is repeated in that refugee processing center every day and at other refugee processing centers around the world too. We are in a world of unprecedented need. 65 million people have been displaced around the world, more than any time in human history. Today, 141 million people need humanitarian assistance. The challenges are growing, but the resources to meet them are shrinking. For the United States, this is a profound humanitarian problem. Americans, both through their private donations and public contributions, put billions of dollars every year into humanitarian relief because we think it's the right thing to do. But from an American perspective, it's also a security problem and a strategic problem. It's a political unrest problem and a counter-radicalization problem. It threatens many of our allies and it threatens to disrupt the international system from which we derive so much of our security. We cannot think of this in only one basket. It's a complex problem that spans regions and taps into a wide variety of functional areas. It leads right to the core of who we are, what kind of world we live in, and how safe we are at home and abroad. If we're serious about U.S. national security, we cannot afford not to be serious about the humanitarian agenda. The importance and complexity of this challenge makes me all the more delighted that today, CSIS is launching a center-wide initiative encompassing our regional and functional programs entitled The Humanitarian Agenda in cooperation with USAID's Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. With OFDA's support, we'll bring together the best minds in the world to analyze the rising humanitarian issues of the 21st century. Together, we will help articulate solutions that can make a difference for U.S. national interests. We're currently in the strategy phase, identifying where we can have the most impact. Our goal for today's discussion is to examine evolving trends in humanitarian assistance. What's changed in the last decade? What makes our response most effective? To start our dialogue, we'll hear from Robert Jenkins, Acting Assistant Administrator for USAID's Bureau for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance. He started his career in the field, designing and implementing emergency relief and recovery programs with World Vision International in southern Sudan and Sierra Leone, as well as working with South Africa as liaison between the Anglican Church, Peace and Justice Office, and township communities. Over the past two decades, Rob has served in many leadership positions at USAID as a career civil servant, including director of USAID's Office of Transition Initiatives, or OTI. During his time within OTI, he provided support to programs in Iraq, Macedonia, Serbia, Montenegro, Kosovo, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Nigeria. I'm honored to welcome Rob to CSIS, to a groundbreaking partnership, and to the stage. Thank you, Rob.
Hello, everybody, and thank you, John. It's always wonderful to be a participant here at CSIS and always an honor. And thank you to all of you. It's heartening to see so many people turning out today to be part of this new humanitarian agenda as we launch it and this event we have. And with that, I need to thank Kimberly Flowers, who made this event and is going to make this whole project and partnership possible. So thank you very much, and thank you in advance for what I know is going to be a great partnership and all the work and all the results that are going to come out of this new wonderful collaboration. So thanks. So John did an excellent job scoping out and describing the situation with the numbers and what we're looking at around the world. And sadly, I think almost all of us are too familiar with the challenges that we're all facing, the problems that are besetting our world right now. You know, 20 years ago, 80% of the work that the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance was doing was in response to natural disasters. Today, that number is flipped on its head. 80% of the work that we do is in response to complex crises. Read that as man-made disasters. I do want to stress man-made disasters. But not only are they man-made, they're also protracted. Many of them have no end in sight. New pieces keep being put onto the board. And with every piece, more resources are necessary. More funding, more personnel. The one resource we can't control is we only have the same amount of time. We're having to spend that on more crises at the same time. So more pieces get onto the board, and very few pieces are coming off the board. Syria, Iraq, the four famines. Now there's the crisis in Myanmar and Bangladesh. Add to that a few hurricanes in the Caribbean and a massive earthquake in Mexico. And a few weeks ago, we set for the second time the all-time record of 6 different disaster assistance response teams in the field at the same time. That's a level above our worst case planning figure for staffing. I can say that we at USAID are thrilled about this new partnership with CSIS. Both USAID and CSIS embody thought leadership in our respective fields. And I'm confident that our collaboration presents an awesome opportunity to address some of the world's most challenging, most complex, and most urgent humanitarian challenges. UN reform, implementing the grand bargain, increasingly limited humanitarian access in many, many different places, responding to the ever-growing IDP and refugee crises. Answers to these problems will only be achieved through partnership. And today marks the formal start and the formal launch of a new important partnership. As our administrator, Mark Green, has said, the United States will remain the world's leader in humanitarian assistance. We will continue to stand by the people of the world in their time of need, whomever they are and wherever they are. We will always project our American values into the world's darkest, most distant places. And in so doing, we will defend and support our national security. The United States is the largest humanitarian donor in the world. We provided over $7 billion in FY16, and last year in FY17, over $8 billion, an all-time record. USAID responds to approximately 65 different disasters in a year, in approximately 50 different countries. That's more than one disaster a week. And as evidenced by the recent hurricanes in the Caribbean, USAID, largely through OFTA, has capabilities that no other donor in the world has. Other donors asked us for assistance to help their territories. But we're only a donor. We can do nothing without our partners. Many of you are here. We can do nothing without NGOs. We can do nothing without the UN. And all of us need each other to work together and to find solutions. But for all of the reasons that I've spelled out, we all need to step it up to a new level. We owe it to the millions of people in need around the globe. We owe it to the 65 million people forced from their homes. We owe it to the families trying to find comfort somehow right now in the mud of Bangladesh. We owe it to the South Sudanese living in fragile compounds, afraid to leave. We owe it to the desperate people of Raqqa, who endured life somehow, if you can call it that, under ISIS, then managed some way to escape, and now they want to go home. But their homes and their lives are in rubble. We owe it to the children of Yemen, beset by hunger and cholera, victims of war, where there is little prospect for peace. There are families choked by dust. There are families, many without men, cowering from evil, from Boko Haram, from Al-Shabaab, from ISIS, and in some places, cowering from their own governments, who don't seem to care about them. But we care about them. This community cares about them. The threat, the horror, the suffering, it comes in many forms, all of them horrifying, some of them evil. It can be a typhoon, a hurricane, a mudslide, an earthquake. It can also be urgent, terrifying screams and orders given in the thick of night, punctuated by small arms fire. It can come as the burning of villages. It can come with artillery, airstrikes, barrel bombs, and destruction. Or it can be silent, a threat, a peril, a killer that no one sees, but taps individuals, taps families, taps communities, steals them away in what might become a pandemic that can tap the world. A pandemic that can threaten us all. So are we ready for that? Are we really all doing everything that we can do? All of our conferences, all of our summits, our well-written, finely parsed and edited plans for the future, are we ready? Are we really tackling the problems we need to tackle? Are we really improving on the time scale, the delivery of our assistance, and on the very scale of the assistance itself? There are meetings in Geneva, there's meetings in New York, there's meetings in Istanbul. I just got back Saturday from meetings in Doha. There's this event today. All these resolutions and compacts and the grand bargain, but are we delivering yet? There's resilience, public-private partnerships, harnessing the diaspora. We speak of an elusive nexus. There's a lot of talk. There are a lot of commitments. There are even more pledges. But are we moving ahead? Are we changing and adapting and acting at a pace and scale that is adequate to meet the pace and scale that these threats are mounting and the threats that are being posed to us and at the pace and scale that the suffering is increasing? That is our challenge. That should be both our goal and our objective. Now, all of us got into this business, if you want to call it that, to save the world. In different ways and for different reasons. But the world's moving faster than we can respond. The time for talk is over, and the time for action is upon us. We have to steal a march on all these new terrible developments. We have to mobilize what are the greatest amount of resources ever dedicated to humanitarian assistance, but we have to mobilize them and program them in a way that is more effective, more efficient. It's not enough to talk about innovation. It's time to be truly innovative. It's not enough It's too much talk about being creative and not enough creative solutions. We owe it to the children in the dust, and we owe it to the families in the mud, and we owe it to the taxpayer. Not just the taxpayers of the United States, but taxpayers in all the donor countries of the world who are providing the fuel that powers this humanitarian community. And we owe it to our own national security and the security of the world. I'm sorry to sound hyperbolic, but that's really what we're confronted with. Whether as individuals or organizations or as government. So at USAID, we are truly excited about the humanitarian agenda and the new partnership between CSIS and OFTA. My hope and plea is we move ahead with speed and alacrity, turning thought leadership into actionable ideas and then taking immediate, decisive action. Again, we owe it to the world. We all got into this job to save the world. So let's get down to business. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob, even though he had to go on. That was emotional and powerful. I think his point about needing to step it up and wanting to make this not just more talk, but really hopefully this partnership, this initiative is going to be able to give concrete, fresh policy ideas, but also actionable ideas to try to make an impact. So for today's panel, as we look at sort of the global evolving trends in humanitarian assistance, we wanted to bring together some very different voices in this, and that is what we've done. Jerome Obereit is traveled all the way from Geneva to join us. He's the Secretary General of MSF, or also known as Doctors Without Borders. He's been working for decades for a medical humanitarian organization that delivers aid to the most vulnerable, often in conflict settings. His staff is on the ground every day and providing emergency medical care while also remaining politically neutral. After Jerome, we will move on to the ambassador, of which, of course, my notes are gone now, but that's okay. Yeah. Ambassador Dina Kawar of Jordan has been an ambassador for a few years here to the U.S., but before that, she was a permanent representative to the United Nations, where she was one of the first Arab women, or the first Arab woman, to lead the UN Security Council. She's been a great voice, particularly in issues of a refugee crisis, and of course, in her home country, Jordan is feeling the impact of that more than most. And last, we have Sam Worthington, who is the CEO of Interaction. If you're unfamiliar, although I see a lot of people in the crowd who represent organizations who are part of Interaction, but Interaction is the largest US alliance of NGOs, so hundreds of its partners are the ones who are implementing humanitarian aid on the ground. Sam really understands the linkages between humanitarian assistance, as well as development and peace building. He's also been a great voice in terms of working on UN reforms, including the grand bargain that Rob mentioned. So, Jerome, let's start with you.
Thank you very much, Kimberly, and thank you very much for inviting MSF to this discussion. I will try and cover two main aspects on how our ability to respond has evolved over the years. One internal, more about MSF and maybe the aid sector, and one more external in terms of the environment in which we operate. So Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, is staunchly needs-focused as an organization, and we really look at what patients need today and do not accept that the needs of state building or economic concerns or health policy cause death for a better tomorrow. So we're really about what's going on today. To enable this, we've prioritized to develop an independent capacity, financial capacity, human capacity, logistics capacity. And today, our financial and therefore political independence is owed to the generosity of 6 million donors that support our action, and this support is actually covers 90% of our operations. Now, to maintain the quality of our action, we look to create proximity between the three people that actually enable the delivery. Well, first of all, those that actually are the people we seek to assist, the patients, the displaced, those that are affected by crisis. Then the second group of people are those that deliver the assistance, our staff, partners, fellow physicians that actually support our work. And then finally, there's the enablers of our action, which are those, the people that actually support us through financial means, know-how, or actually direct support, political support, or other. Now, when we look at the system more globally, it has tended to move towards a reality that goes towards the opposite direction. One, more of a common system that actually creates all sorts of dependency on external capacities for key areas such as logistics or security, for instance. Now, this is really a shift that we've seen since the mid-90s, where there's a lot more direct funding that went to field actors, and this enabled a lot of know-how, be it in how to rent a plane, how to negotiate security on the ground, and allowed more creativity in areas which are extremely complicated. So today it seems that a lot of know-how has been lost, and the funding streams require the use of more superstructures, overarching structures, often aiming to deliver on multiple fronts, and these multiple fronts are sometimes in tension, be it humanitarian assistance versus peace building, versus state and development agendas, or purely peacekeeping. Now, security is a good example in terms of what's happened over the last few years. Negotiating directly with armed actors, whether they are state or non-state actors, is really a precondition for us to secure the safe space that our medical team need to care for the victims. Now, this negotiation is what defines what we can provide to people in need, and it also defines the guarantees provided by those who control the violence in a given environment. And this negotiation is a central tenet to our security approach, and it has to really be undertaken by those that deliver the aid. As soon as you actually start separating the ability to deliver and negotiate, and you can't really rely on being able to actually directly do what you say you will be doing in terms of delivery, then you risk actually losing the security that you've negotiated, which is the counter kind of part to this negotiation. And so when we look at the doctors on the field, our staff in general, we can't have them just purely focus on their technical role. Our physicians, our doctors on the field, will themselves be involved in the security discussion around the project itself and in the negotiating with the actors on the ground. Yet when we look at the sector generally, there's a professionalization that seems to be increasing a subcontracting out of, for instance, security measures. And that's a clear challenge for all of us, including our teams, that this professionalization sets in a more structured sector around frameworks that kind of breaks down this holistic approach to actually being able to engage with a given environment. So in turn, this will actually reduce quite often individual responsibility on the ground, the responsibility of being there, of delivering, of negotiating, of accepting a level of risk or not accepting a level of risk, and that also leads to a level of accountability and creativity. So today we have over 35,000 staff operating in the field and working across the world, and our real challenge as MSF is to keep every one of them as an individual actor and a decision maker in a very difficult environment in which they're faced. So the answers to the challenges really sit with them and maintaining their critical voice at the center of our action, a people-focused approach as opposed to an over-systemic response, is what will manage us to maintain our operations on the ground in what's an increasingly complex and interconnected world. So in addition to maintaining this culture of direct action and really engagement, we need also to maintain a culture of questioning, putting in tension all our dilemmas out in the public. And in fact, our work is all about compromises. Whether it's the broad principles that actually define humanitarian action, we need to be able to openly share how we break these compromises, how we put them in tension constantly, and learn from one another. And in fact, it's not very easy for a sector that's very dependent on external generosity to openly be self-critical about our action and allow us to learn from each other and how to do better in the future. Now, quite interestingly, is we are facing a social media environment which will actually provide a self-reflection with more informed public, but also more informed beneficiaries that themselves will be putting ourselves in tension and will be scrutinizing the NGOs. Now, when we look at the external factors, there's a constant trend that we're seeing that our teams are facing, whether it's from conflict to epidemics, or to the reality of refugees, the displaced populations more broadly, in how humanitarian response are triggered, which is usually by threat today rather than by needs. When you look at the global health, it's now rebranded as a global health security. Again, what is the security part of the global health security leads to a lot of questioning. And against this backdrop of never-ending war against terrorism, delivering aid is primarily released when states feel threatened by a crisis, and the response to the needs of others driven by self-interest will by definition be ill-adapted to the needs of those that are in acute situations. Now, when we look at the different areas of response, it was selective humanitarianism that dictated the Ebola response. A deep sense of urgency only emerged when Ebola-infected people started to reach the shores of the US and Europe. An earlier response would have prevented much. More than 28,000 people got infected, 11,000 died, and reacting to the epidemic really only started when it started knocking on people's door. Now, was the Ebola response a success? Yes, if you define success as keeping Ebola out of the US and Europe. No, if success is about saving the maximum amount of lives in West Africa. When looking at war zones, patients and medical staff are being crushed by this anti-terror agenda, bulldozed by a narrative that increasingly paints all opponents as terrorists. While not new, military forces and non-state actors routinely and flagrantly disregard the protection of civilians and the norms and laws governing humanitarian action. The worry is that today it seems that this oversight or this complete bulldozing over these norms is becoming normalized and acceptable. The national security interests of states are used to justify wars without limits. Humanitarian aid is welcome when it serves security objectives and is often restricted or attacked when it does not. These abuses violate the fundamental principles of impartial medical care, the prioritization of treatment on the needs of patients only, and only on their health. As our experience in Kunduz, Afghanistan, when the US Air Force bombed an MSF hospital, leading to the single largest loss of our staff in our history, or the reality of Yemen, where the destruction of hospitals and sanitation infrastructure has led to one of the largest ever cholera outbreak, ongoing attacks on civilians and humanitarians are described as mere mistakes or unfortunate collateral damage, with no further explanation. This is again a clear sign of normalization. The impartial provision of aid to everyone in need, including wounded and sick combatants, has de facto become criminalized in some places, and we worry that this is an increasing trend. Doctors being criminalized are arrested for treating quote-unquote so-called terrorists or criminals. A patient and patients risk their lives by trying to access or seeking care. As Zhuan Liu, our president, said, we cannot accept a logic where the doctor of my enemy is my enemy. Now, moving on to people on the move, much the same reality is faced. Moving is not a crime, yet today's political and social climate fuels hostility towards undesired refugees, asylum seekers, or migrants, which in turn fuels repressive state policies of subjection and rejection. As a consequence, people on the move are institutionally situated in a criminalized environment. We see the consequences of these institutional policies and practices of repression, containment, deportation, and deterrence firsthand along the Balkan routes in Europe, in Libya, in Greece, in France, and here in the US. Yet mobility continues undeterred. Existential threats still exist in countries of origins. Children needing to flee El Salvador yesterday, today, tomorrow. People must move to survive acute conflict and rampant violence. Violence and war often fueled or supported by the very nations that reject refugees. These restrictive policies therefore simply serve to rechannel displacement and migration into illegal, high-cost, and high-risk alternatives and propel people and individuals to their death. In this environment, assistance to people on the move is an act of solidarity, yet increasingly it risks being seen as a crime, as we've seen in the search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean. There is an urgent need to turn this policy of this tide of policy criminalization, and action at all levels must be underlain by a bedrock of protection and assistance. Solidarity must preside. Last month, MSF communicated about Libya, where thousands of migrants fleeing conflict, famine, persecution, or poverty were being starved, abused, tortured, and exploited as a commodity at an industrial level. As long as the push factors don't change, brutal war, hunger, rampant poverty, and abusive regimes, people will continue to flee. By pouring money into containing them in exploitative reality, such as Libya, governments are perpetuating their abuse. Since August 25th, hundreds of thousands of people have poured across the border of Myanmar, a wave of desperate humanity. While Europe and the US are bragging about their successful migrant deterrent policies, Bangladesh, Jordan, Lebanon, or Kenya have welcomed and provided for millions of refugees. So to conclude, as a humanitarian medical organization, we see a reality of millions of people that exist in displacement, in disease, and in danger. If the goal of humanitarian action, regardless of who delivers it, is to improve health and dignity, we must react based on needs first and foremost. It means stepping back from the security at all cost logic that abstracts the real needs for those facing the worst humanity has to offer. It means not putting your sense of security over the health and lives of others. It means carving out a safe space for them, a space of humanity. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, before we move on, I have to ask you, sir, can you clap? Because there seems to be a thread of words that I'm hearing in your remarks of safe space and of opponents as terrorists and talking about the security negotiations. And you know, there seems to be a level of insecurity for your own staff that we haven't seen in years past. As you know, CSIS recently launched its first full documentary, a feature film called The New Barbarianism, which is by our Global Health Policy Center. And it talks about frontline health workers being targeted in attacks. And I just want to ask before we move on, as someone who manages your operations, are you having to do things differently to keep your staff protected? And are there any particular steps that you feel are not being taken in regards to whether it's the Geneva Convention or just in international humanitarian law being respected or not?
Well, first of all, I think we have to be careful to say that it was a golden age of humanitarianism where there was access everywhere. I mean, I don't think in my time working with MSF over the past 20 years, there's ever been an easy place when you're going to conflicts to actually say, we've got access, and that, you know, just our name would give us access. Now, I think today one of the main changes is that some of the frames that we were able, and of course they were never absolute uphold and that governments would uphold, whether they're the refugee conventions or whether it's actually IHL, are being completely disregarded in basic operational terms, whether it's how Europe is actually dealing with those knocking on their doors and actually locking all safe passage options into Europe. Pushing people to take more dangerous routes by not having the land routes open and actually treating people not as individuals where you can actually seek to see how far each one of them is able to have the refugee rights, which is what the conventions are about, and actually treating more people as herds that come from somewhere and that their individuality is taken away from them. When you're going to look at people as groups, you have to allow them in, because de facto you're saying they've been persecuted, or we don't have the ability to look at them as individual, but we recognize where they come from. But you have no right to lock them out into these conflict zones, to actually lock them out in places like Libya, which is actually what we're seeing. So the norms, and it's the same for IHL, when we look at, being able, I mean, the basic laws of war we're seeing are being baffled in terms of the name of terrorism, and the war on terror. And this is something that definitely has changed over the past years. Now, I think we have to be careful. I'm not too sure we can say it's a more dangerous job to do today. It's always been very dangerous. We have to look at where the limits are. And sometimes the limits are actually drawn up by how people conduct war, including governments, which are supposed to be the first and foremost to uphold these norms.
Thank you very much. Ambassador Kawar, what are we missing, or what are you looking at?
Okay. Thank you, Kimberly, and thank you. I want to commend you for taking up this humanitarian agenda, which is really a challenge for everybody. And I want to say a few words before I talk about Jordan, because obviously we're in the midst of one of the worst crises of refugees ever, is that before coming here, I was at the UN, like you mentioned, ambassador there, and I was given the privilege of co-facilitating the refugee summit alongside with my colleague from Ireland. And of course, as you know, the Refugee Convention is a convention that was created a long time ago and that needs a lot of changes that can work with today's crises and challenges. And I would add to that that the issue of migration is not at all within the convention, the Refugee Convention, and that's another issue that needs to be dealt with, and that's completely different from the aspect of refugees, given that migrants do leave their home and do go elsewhere to work and build other countries and also participate to its economy. So you could find that there are divisions in the world about the issue of refugees on one hand and migrants and the interest of migration. You would find it more in Latin America and East Asia, much more than in other countries. But let's go back to Jordan, for which I think the reason you invite me today is that Jordan happens to be the number one country in the world that has a number of refugees. We actually did our statistics and found that 13% of our population is made out of refugees, be it Syrian, which is the last bag of refugees, but also the Palestinians and others from Iraq, from Yemen, from other countries. So for a country that is the population now, or the total population is around 9 million, and it is a country that is not in a very easy region, with surrounded by wars and by conflicts all around and by complications, which has made it even triple difficult. So since the we're in the seventh year of war, and Jordan has managed to integrate around 1.37 million Syrian refugees, which is almost 20% of our population. 20% of the Jordanian population as such. And the other day I was asking somebody how many people would that do percentage-wise in the U.S., and they said that you have to double Canada's population and invite them to the United States. So I think people don't realize the complexity of this challenge that our government and our country. However, we did it because of humanitarian reasons. You cannot see children. I mean, if you see the photos, and of children and mothers and old people walking through the night just to get to safe haven, how could you just tell them, you know, go away, we don't want you? And it has been a challenge for the government. Add to that only 10% of these populations do live in the camps. The rest do live in village, in the towns all around the country. Now, as you all know, Jordan is not an oil-producing country. We have our challenges. We have our own unemployment. We have our trade routes with Syria and Iraq that have been completely shut off, although we have opened our routes with Iraq just recently. You know that our market, we do not have any market anywhere in the West Bank. What can I tell you more? The unemployment is almost very high and amongst the youth. And then the government said, okay, we have this situation, what can we do to deal with it? And that's where I must say they were completely innovative, and it was one of those situations where they took the worst and tried to do something about it. In normal days, much of the aid goes to the refugees directly. In the situation of the Syrian refugees, it would not have been possible because most of them are outside. So we worked with, starting with the English, but also with the international donors, and said, let's do a different model of dealing with refugees, which I think, in my opinion, is the first, and that will be done everywhere else in the world. Let's work on the host community. Let's work on increasing the resilience of the host community, and in return, the host community would do its part, its share of not only receiving, but also making sure that refugees get the right education, get the right healthcare, and even get jobs. So we put the figures down and we said, what could we do? And basically what we did is that the hardest part was the first 2 years, because the schools were overloaded. Classes were 50 students a class. Teachers were doing double shifts. So it not only was an impossibility, but it also affected the quality of our own public education. When we did the compact with the international community, and 2 years ago we went to London, and all of the donors agreed to help us out. The money that was coming into Jordan, although not all of it did come, but that money that was coming was helping us in opening schools, improving the quality of schooling and of teachers, opening more classes. And eventually, right now, we can say that 90% of all Syrian children have an education, either formal or non-formal. When I say formal, it means in the public schools or within the UN agencies. And at least they have that. Medical is of course, offered to Syrians through our hospitals and our systems. But more importantly, we looked at also the figures and said why we have 18 development areas, what we call development areas, then how come we have allowed ourselves to have a percentage of foreign labor? We have foreign labor, that's the Syrian sitting at home, so let's get them to work. And up to now, we have delivered 70,000 work permits. I say that because you have to realize we have our own unemployment, but we managed to say, let's do it that way, and let's give certain of the jobs that do anyway go to foreigners, help them to go to the Syrians instead of giving them to our population. And this has helped a lot. Now, why are we doing that? Okay, we're humanitarian, but there's also other reasons as well. Syria is a country, a neighbor country, and it's very important that these kids go to school, because as the UN system says that any refugee has 17 years out of home. Can you imagine 17 years with children? That's how many generations. Do you think that it is wise in the Arab world to have children go out without education, without a future that's planned for them? So we looked at it from a even self-interest, interest of the region, that these children have to go to school. The same for medical and the same for jobs, because we think that there has to be a sort of independency of these families. Now, we did negotiate with the Europeans to have the rules of origin sort of exception for Jordan, and already two of the eight companies that started exporting to Europe, two of them are Syrian companies based out of Jordan. So this has been a successful and an interesting way of doing business, and I think that, in my opinion, this will be sort of a lesson or an example to lead other countries. And I must also underline here that it's not an easy job, because we're actually putting a quarter of our annual budget for refugee-related issues. And that's putting a lot of pressure and tension on us because of the budget deficits and the expenses that are going. But I do not like to talk about numbers here, although if I were to show you, you would realize the impossibility of the task. But I do not like to put numbers, because behind each number, each refugee, is a story and a human story. And I really hate it when we start to talk about refugees, but we're obliged to say numbers, because it's a reality and it's something that the government needs to deal with. But from a humanitarian point of view, you're talking about people and their suffering. So this has been a unique experience for our country. I must say that I keep saying to myself, hopefully that the political situation will come back into order, the political process will start, we'll see some reconstruction in Syria once the political horizon is cleared. And we're hoping that these refugees one day or another would go back home, but would maintain certain ties with us, because some of them by then would have been many, many years in Jordan. And I also think that no matter what we say, their presence in Jordan has also given some changes in the social scene, in the economic scene, and even in our food and the way we do things. There's always certain changes that are positive when you have a whole foreign community coming. And I wouldn't say foreign, because Syrians are Arabs, and we have many families in the north of Jordan that are related to other families in the south, so they're Arab speaking. So I think that's all, and I don't know what more to add, except to say that this has been a unique experience for Jordan. Thank you.
Thank you. Earlier this year, I was in Djibouti, and I was at the Obak refugee camp meeting with Yemeni refugees there, and for other research looking at food security issues. But I was really struck at some of the cultural differences, and I think about 20% of your population now that are Syrian, whether they're only a small percentage in camps, so they're really being integrated into your communities. Do you get the sense that this will have what kind of impact on whether it's political or social? Is it going to change Jordan forever, what's happening now?
Well, I mean, the thing with the Syrian population is that they're Arab, they speak the same language, the same religion. So in that sense, it's not that culture shock that maybe would happen between Syrians and Turkey or Syrians who've gone to Europe or elsewhere. So in that sense, it's easier for them as it is for us. And whatever cultural change there is, it's minimal. It's not. I mean, the only thing I can say, you learn the good things from the other, right? And in that sense, it's very important. But however, there has been some impacts on other issues, social issues, which are sad to see. For example, early marriages that have been that we've been seeing among the Syrian population, because much of the time poverty leads to parents wanting to, and sometimes these marriages don't even last because they just, you know, that's sad and early. So the role that many of the NGOs are playing and with the government, because we're very careful about these issues of early marriages and pregnancies and things, is that trying to help, you know, bring awareness. There are many workshops, many efforts to get jobs for Syrian girls. And it's very touching because sometimes you see all these workshops of people starting to do photography or art or filmmaking, and then all of a sudden, you have these young Syrian women who start to say, what a wonderful experience we've had to discover that we have this talent. And to, so in all sad stories, there's always good ones that come out. But it's a big, big challenge to them and to us. And definitely the social impact is the one that will be very difficult to handle. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. Sam, what are you thinking about these days?
Well, thank you for this opportunity and this great initiative. The world, as we've heard here, MSF Jordan has built an amazing humanitarian infrastructure. You have countries stepping up, hosting at times millions of displaced people. The NGO community has stepped in where nation states and the UN have had challenges. In many ways, we probably have the largest humanitarian infrastructure in place since the Second World War. And yet, the gap between the capacity of that infrastructure and the scale of the problem continues to grow. We are confronted with certain basic realities. Half of the world's most extreme people living in the most extreme situations of poverty are now living in complex, fragile environments where there's some form of conflict. We're seeing the largest displacement of individuals since the Second World War. We hear of things when they hit the West. We don't tend to focus on the Central African Republics and on the DRCs and other places. We hear when refugees hit Western Europe and a million in, or I think we've declined them to 50,000 in this country, and then a million people would go across the border, or in the case of Myanmar Rohingya, some 700,000 people are now living largely in stateless conditions. So we have this enormous gap between the capacity of the international system and of governments themselves and the magnitude of the problem. Even though we've doubled the amount of resources going into the international, and the US government is in many, many ways a leader of those new resources. More resources, more capacity, growing gap. And I think that's the first reality we have to live with. The second reality is the world has committed itself to the Sustainable Development Goals. And the Achilles heel of that vision is the fact that half the world's extreme poor live in fragile and conflict-ridden states. We know in environments that are more stable how to reduce infant mortality rates, how to increase literacy, how to increase the longevity of a life of a family, and so forth. In fragile environments, we do not know how to increase the well-being of humanity nearly at the scale that is needed, and particularly since the level of conflict is increasing, and that the challenge we've recognized is that ultimately it's the intersection between the humanitarian community, the development community, and the peace-building community. But each community approaches this with very different mindsets. Humanitarian community is saving lives. It is about the well-being and the life of people and in a neutral, impartial way of doing so. The development community ultimately is focused on the sustainability of the well-being of a people, which means you focus in on markets and the state and the role the state could play. Peace building, you're looking at the degree of security in an environment and the ability to ensure some form of lasting peace. These communities are somewhat at odds with each other, but until all three come together, and where it's the most difficult to bring them together is in these fragile environments. And that's the shift. We talk about the humanitarian community as something international, but the reality is the vast majority of any humanitarian intervention is local. There's always local people who respond, and they respond at a level of engagement that then either is too much for a particular government, a particular population, and the international community comes in. So we are trying to fill a gap that is already being trying to address on a local level. So we have to recognize that the response is ultimately local. And then there's a gap on top of that happening. And we've built a system which makes sense and has logics to it and so forth, and it has become much better than in the past, but it was built on the backs of natural disasters. It was built to respond to typhoons, hurricanes, earthquakes, and so forth. It was not built for sustained long-term complex crises or long-term displacements of people. And so the overall humanitarian system is having to repurpose itself and readjust itself to a much more complex environment. I'm simplifying because there were complex emergencies going way back. But the percentage of them and the magnitude of them compared to natural disasters, as was referenced with AFTA funding, is a significant change. The challenge with complex emergencies is that every single context is different. If you're responding in Somalia right now, there's tremendous amounts of local capacity. Yes, there are some horrible bombs that have gone off recently, but there's significant market capacity and local capacity to respond. If you're responding in the Central African Republic, you don't have that local capacity and you don't have the degree of markets. In Yemen, you're negotiating with major actors in terms of access through the port. And in other places, such in Jordan, you're engaging and partnering with a government that's working with you to try to solve a problem. So you do not have, in essence, norms that you could follow because each one is state-specific and centric to there. And this is where the NGOs, in essence, play in to try to fill a further gap. The barriers in front of the humanitarian response, not just in terms of resources and capacity, are increasing. And I think perhaps the one that is the most disturbing is that the lessons that we learned in the 20th century of how not to fight wars, of how not to target civilians, of how not to ensure that, in essence, a total war upon a population, we learned lessons that said that there needs to be a degree of access, that there needs to be impartial, humane action on the battlefield and in conflict zones. As non-state actors began to violate those norms, increasingly we're seeing state actors violate those norms, whether it's the Russians in Syria, or the Saudis in Yemen, or Boko Haram, or Daesh. The amount of space available for humanitarian actors to have access to where they need to provide life-saving services is declining. And in essence, we are unlearning the lessons of the 20th century in the type of space that is required in a war zone to save lives. And this lack of respect for international humanitarian law is deeply ingrained. And I think the challenge here is how do you create those boundaries? The US military has significant trainings in this regard, but the degree to which civilians are targeted by all militaries or seen as casualties of war, it makes it increasingly more difficult for humanitarians to intervene. As most circumstances, when you have multiple actors engaging to try to solve a problem, the world tends to love this word called coordination. It's sort of like motherhood and apple pie. But the problem is too much motherhood and too much apple pie is not necessarily good for you. And what we've done here is we are put coordination on top of coordination on top of systems without remembering that ultimately it is where the humanitarian system meets people where we need coordination, and not necessarily between large systems relating to each other, whether it's UN systems relating to each other, states, or NGOs. And our desire to coordinate has now become an end in itself. And the end has to always be the degree to which we are aligning resources on the ground as best as possible, even if there isn't the degree of coordination that we want over time. And we've, in essence, made the bureaucracy a necessity in and of itself, and that needs to be questioned. Now, is there a way forward out of this? On the resource side, I'm not sure. The burden that is going to will be borne by emerging economies and other more fragile states around areas of conflict is likely going to go up. The role that the NGOs and other non-state actors have to play where states have failed will also likely increase. We will find ourselves more in a situation of triage between resources and where those resources are available, and this despite the fact that the American people, these are the, not the taxpayers, but just the donations, is about $500 million a year just in donations going out there, and we heard the $8 billion that goes in through OFTRA and the U.S. government. There isn't, there won't be the resources. Means more pressure on local states. There will be attempts to find better ways to get resilience and development efforts in place. It's the farmer who's able to feed her family through the drought by ensuring that she has the capacity to feed rather than simply being fed. That reality we may be able to make some progress on. Again, the complexity in states. And this is where the push of the humanitarian community comes in, is ultimately it comes down to diplomacy. The willingness of states to step in and stop wars. Because humanitarianism is not a tool to stop war, it is a tool to save lives. And that frame will change. And then we end up with this thing that's been called the grand bargain. What it is an attempt to take some of the best lessons of what it will take to change things on where humanitarian interventions meet people. And one of those core lessons is that it has to be more local. More resources have to be locally focused, whether they're local institutions or institutions of significantly local capacity. There need to be less restrictions on the resources that are going in and longer term resources. Thinking going back to the 17 years, there has to be education resources and others available over time. And the challenge for the UN and others is there has to be less of a bureaucratic infrastructure in the way, adding cost to the overall structure with more resources actually going where they need to go. That grand bargain, which is a trade-off between the UN, the donors, the NGOs, and states, is something that will enable us, hopefully, to reach more lives. But unfortunately, it's not going to close the gap that we're confronted with.
Thank you, Sam. I have to ask, although you're digging into it a little bit, but talking about the coordination upon coordination and thinking back on the Global Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul last year, which it was new and never done before. There were a lot of momentum, a lot of promises that came out of that. Is it too early to say, how are we doing? Is it too early to say, what are the reforms that have been made? Or what are your thoughts on the real progress that came out of that event?
I mean, in many ways, the progress in that event was who attended. It was the diversity of civil society actors across the global south. It was all states. It was the private sector. It wasn't some small group saying we are the humanitarians of the world. It was the recognition that the concept of being a humanitarian is universal and requires multiple actors to do that. So that, in and of itself, was a breakthrough. I think the challenge is there are small interventions that are called humanitarian, but when you talk about interventions that will impact a million people, you're talking things at scale with massive systems being put in place. Those systems are slow to evolve. And I think one of our challenges coming out that we tried to do everything in that first year out there. The current effort led by Kristalina Georgieva, there's ourselves, the International Community Red Cross, and a number of governments are in an effort to focus in on, if you had to make two or three changes, where could you make them? And the challenge that really does require compromises and some form of bargaining going on between donors, nation states, the UN, and the NGOs. Mm-hmm. And that means that we have to change the way we do business in some ways. And that works against the interests of bureaucracies and other such things in place.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador, I know you have to depart in a few minutes, so I'm going to ask a few more questions or any other final thoughts that you have. One is thinking through, since you've created this model of resilience, of how you can step up and integrate these refugees the best that you can without hampering your economic prosperity, are you sharing those lessons with other countries? And how has that been sort of, received amongst the donor community? Are you getting the kind of support that you need to make that happen?
Well, actually, I wouldn't say it's not hampering our economic, we are suffering economically, and that's definitely something very important to take into consideration. But to go back to your question, just as you said, the World Bank, for example, is now working with us in a very aggressive and way to try and help us in all the development projects that we have to do. The World Bank realizes that whatever penny they put in helping out Jordan is money that they will get in a different way. So definitely they have been on board. The United States has been very supportive, and we're very thankful for their support. Other countries like in Europe and in Japan. So obviously, but I think that the NGOs who work in Jordan right now are seeing this way of coordination in a more efficient way. And definitely the case of Jordan helps, because if they're dealing with a government that is aware that it's, taking things in hand, and it's not a war zone like it would be some other places where it gets more complicated. So I think that whatever experiment we're doing in Jordan and whatever lessons we learn from it, it's going to be for the UN a model. And I must say that, the Guterres, who was the UNHCR, came to Jordan many times when he was in that post, and he recognizes, and he did help a lot Jordan, and he recognizes all the lessons and has helped us throughout. So I think that the experts in the humanitarian field know and realize the importance also of the private sector coming in and helping create jobs and doing projects that need to be done in order to employ and make the economic wheel go and turn for the better. So I think that there's a totally new way of dealing with refugees that we'll be seeing more and more. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. Let's give a round of applause to Ambassador Kaur, since he has to depart a bit early.
Can I go ahead? Thank you so much.
I'm going to come into the middle here so that we can see more of this side of the room. We're going to turn now to the audience for questions. So please raise your hands high. We do have a live webcast happening, so be sure whenever you speak into the microphone that you give your name and your organization, as well as, can we get a microphone right up here, as well as if your question is directed to one of our panelists or to both. Ambassador Hazard, can you stand?
Thank you, Kimberly, and it's a real pleasure to be here for this launch. I just wanted the perspective from both of you, and of course being a doctor, the whole preventive approach and many of the crises that the preventive approach has proven to work, and I worked on one in Ethiopia and with the help of USAID, and I just wanted your thoughts on that. It's very, very difficult to get funding, and it's very difficult to get attention, because the world really only opens up its eyes when it becomes a crisis that starts to hit the US or Europe. But I just wonder your thoughts on sort of a preventive approach, which would have to bring in, of course, the UN, but also our Congress that funds these endeavors and things, and I just wanted your perspective on that. Thank you.
Can you introduce yourself for those who don't know you?
Hi, I'm Pat Haslak, worked on most recently on Ethiopia, so it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Great, thank you. Other questions or comments from the audience? Don't be shy, we know you have thoughts. Emmy, you're never shy.
There are lots of questions, actually, and I like the Emmy Simmons, somewhat associated with CSIS right now as a senior advisor. Lots of questions, and I appreciated Sam Worthington's kind of distinction between not just the humanitarian community and the development community, but really the emergence of this peace building and security kind of community, because I think it actually has complicated the grand bargain even more, because that community was not actually involved in that discussion at all. So that was, to me, a very useful thought advance. But I wanted to just question you guys on something that Rob Jenkins said that really surprised me, and the strength of his saying that we owe, or people owe, people in Myanmar, people in Bangladesh, people in Yemen, support, using that term owe, because that's been very much rejected by so many people. They say, well, you know, we have a broad responsibility, for a moral responsibility for taking care of our fellow man. But if you put it in that expression that, well, we owe the people of Yemen to take care of them, I would think that that would be kind of a very sensitive and controversial question. So I just wanted to throw that back to you. Unfortunately, Rob's not here, so he won't hear the answer, but I just found it very interesting. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Emmy. Other questions or comments from the audience? Let's come right here to the very front. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, Ron Waldman from George Washington University. Thanks for your remarks, and to the ambassador as well.
Can you stand up, please? Our live webcast can see the back of your head.
So, Jerome, you talked about the golden age of humanitarianism, and Sam, you pointed out also that things are changing quite a lot. They really are, and you know, I'm also involved with a medical NGO. I'm the president of Médecins du Monde, Doctors of the World, USA. And so I want to maybe direct my comments more to Jerome and ask a question, because it's an interesting situation that you alluded to without mentioning specifically, but a UN agency, the World Health Organization, has hired medical doctors to be embedded with security forces in Iraq, in Mosul specifically, which is really not consistent with the kinds of humanitarian principles that were advanced during the golden age, so to speak. So I'm wondering, as the world changes, Sam, and I think that Jerome would agree that it's changing as well, what happens to those principles on which humanitarianism is based? Can they remain embedded without change, or do they have to be adapted as well to meet the conditions of the changing world?
Excellent. Thank you so much. Let's start with you, Jerome.
Okay. So I'll start with last questions. It's always easier to remember.
Sure. I'll remind you the other one.
I'll try and move forward. Now, I think, you know, first of all, I don't think there was a golden age. You know, that's the issue. We have to be careful not to say that we had ever full access and easy a situation. But I think your question on Mosul and embedding is actually quite an interesting one. And it really, you know, the beginning in Afghanistan is where we really saw at one point more embedded organization following, you know, the German organizations following the German contingents. You had the English NGOs more where the English contingents were, and so on and so forth. And I think at that point there was a big question that was raised, you know, is there a new form of humanitarianism? And everyone's saying, you know, MSF, it's finished, you know, your kind of principled approach is gone and over. What do you see today is actually everyone wants to distance themselves from the military. You see a reality where actually they're being targeted and there's no solutions that have been found. So again, I don't want to say that we own a way of doing things. And, you know, in fact, the fighting forces have an obligation to provide health care for those that are being displaced. So if they're subcontracting organizations to actually be embedded in terms of their midst to actually provide, do it, but be clear that you're not actually doing humanitarian work, you're actually fulfilling your role as an armed actor engaged in a conflict. The problem is that now everything's being mixed up. You know, you can be doing, and again, I have no problem that there's medical teams embedded with the military. That's part, you know, that's far from me to say less medical work. Yes, more, but actually be clear about what you are and what you're providing, and don't create a kind of complete, you know, mix of all roles of who you are. And it's interesting hearing the discussion. Here is the Humanitarian Forum, and I would actually say that the World Humanitarian Summit was a bit the same. They talked about solutions to situations. They didn't talk about providing humanitarian action today for those most in need. So, you know, it was about, well, how do we then deal? How do we build up peace? How do we create this and create that? Actually, that's necessary. That's very important, but it's not. That's not going to be the enabler to actually provide for the person who is in a dire situation today. That's going to be a solution which is not our pay grade as MSF, and we're very clear about this. Our pay grade is actually to provide for the here and now. The pay grade of the solutions are much more political realities which we're not involved in. And so, you know, if I have a criticism in terms of a lot of, we need prevention, we need peace building, but that's not humanitarian work per se. That's not what we, and again, we don't own the name humanitarian, but quite often it's a very difficult one to actually be able to say, is there enough resources? How do we bring back capacity that's independent, capable of actually reaching an area in South Sudan and not linked to the peacekeeping forces that are then assimilated with more the government or more the rebel forces and so on that can be detached from there when the whole logistics is being all mixed up? So how can we create a capacity that's actually simple in its objective, but that is not completely assimilated to all the other actors and all the other important issues that had to happen, but that's different. And, you know, it's becoming more and more difficult. So I agree there's a nexus where we have to engage, and of course as a humanitarian we have to engage with political powers on the ground. You know, when we went back to Afghanistan a few years back, we actually engaged with the American government as we engaged with the Taliban. They both hold the guns. We need to talk to both of them to negotiate our space. It didn't fully work, unfortunately, in terms of what we faced a few years further down the line. But you know, we have to be very careful about what humanitarianism is. And if we mix everything in the same pot, we're not going to be able to find a space on how to provide, how to create that space of humanity for those that face the worst the world has to offer today. Now, so that kind of answers, I think, a bit of the question about the peace building and to a certain extent preventive approaches, which is a lot more complex because there's a lot of prevention you can do once you are in a humanitarian situation in terms of vaccination or in terms of a direct medical, which is, but there the situation is there. You're not preventing the humanitarian situation to occur. You're preventing a worse situation to emerge in a sense. And then finally on, do we owe it? Well, I don't think we should take the moral high ground that we owe it to anybody. You know, we've made a choice, which is a self-given mandate as MSF, to actually go and answer to those based on need, first and foremost. And so that's our given mandate, but I don't think, you know, that's a very political kind of question that a country specifically owes it to another one. You know, we're doing this from a very non-political kind of engagement.
Is it hard sometimes to say apolitical, to stay neutral? There's some conflicts or some countries where it's hard to sustain that trust on both sides?
Well, I think, you know, we've got to be clear that we are a political actor by the very nature of what we do. Mm-hmm. We're apolitical because we're driven from a perception of needs and needs alone and not by a political agenda beyond that. Mm-hmm. But we're clear, you know, we're coming in with resources, we're providing for people which are being excluded on purpose to get, for certain powers to actually get an advantage. So, of course, we become politically involved. Yeah. But not through a political motivation other than answering needs.
Right. Thank you. Sorry, I interjected. Sam, responses to those questions?
Yeah, so just again, a broader framing coming from the scope of the interaction community. So it's a community that manages $15.4 billion a year. What's interesting of that is only 24% of that is the US government. So there's the generosity of the American people, partnerships with the private sector are enormous in this mix. Now about a third of that total resource base is humanitarian focused. So you end up with organizations that are dual mandated, development, humanitarian, and they have organizations that are purely focused on peace building and purely focused on humanitarian. So you get that whole spectrum in the place. Prevention does make a difference. There is a big difference between Typhoon Haiyan coming through the Philippines with hardened places for civilians to run to, than when the typhoon worked its way up and hit Myanmar and killed far more people. There's an enormous difference in terms of natural disaster. The same thing applies if there are recurring famines and if you have food banks and a range of ways to plant during a drought and prepare for a drought and be resilient to drought. Again, also enormous yields on your investment. Now, why Congress doesn't get this? We've been pushing disaster risk reduction for over and over and over again. In fact, it is even more so in a conflict state. You know, if you could avoid the conflict in the first place, you're going to be spending far less resources than you will otherwise. So we've learned how to prevent famines in non-conflict environments through prevention. There's no reason for a famine in this world. The only reason we have a famine is when it's associated with some form of conflict or some form of inability of us to prepare for that. So I think that's the sort of reality and prevention. As NGOs, we always start with common humanity. This is about who we are as human beings, and this is what we do. The moment you talk to Capitol Hill administration, we have to deal with the reality of national security, and this is in your national interest to do that. As humanitarians, we cringe a bit about the national security bit, but sort of accept that, but reality of the two can live together if there's some degree of balance. The OIT, I've heard, in a sense, when it comes to climate change and some form of associated that climate change responsible from the North, but it's certainly not a political argument that would resonate pretty much anywhere around here. On the principles, in many ways, the principles are becoming more important. Interaction and negotiated with the Secretary of Defense, some norms of operating in kinetic environments between the Department of Defense and the NGO sector. And in some places it was, don't touch us here. Here's where we do not want you anywhere near us. Here's where we're going to draw a fence and we need to talk across the top of that fence. And here's where we'll collaborate. And it's being very clear about the respective roles of the different actors. And for the NGO community, particularly those in humanitarian environments, every year in our forum, we go through a process of reading names. And it's 20 to 40 people who were killed in the last year in the line of the duty of their jobs. And they were killed and we're not getting protection from guns. Protection is through negotiated relationships with local populations. And the ability to function in those types of environment is the ability to say that you are impartial, that you are neutral, that you are not an extension of a military agenda or your government's agenda. The challenge is that in a different part, a different place of the world, you are doing something with the U.S. government, an extension or program, whether it's Feed the Future or others, where you're saving lives and making a difference in the ability of human beings to feed themselves. We recognize that that continuum exists, but the closer you get to an environment that is violent, the more you have to operate with some sense of defining yourself as not an extension of one side or the other of the combatants. And that ability to do so as humanitarian actors is the not just a principle, it is ultimately what enables you to work.
In the interest of time, we're just going to take two more quick questions or comments. So raise your hand high. It's come here in the front, and then we'll go right there to the back. You'll be our final two.
Hi. I don't know how quick this is. The answer could take a day or two. my name is Mindy Reiser. I'm vice president of an NGO called Global Peace Services USA to talk about that community. I'd like you to talk a little bit, both of you, about the macro question here with a number of countries cutting back on at least their verbal commitments to international action, looking at the interests of their own country first. And there's a certain complexity to what Robert Jenkins said about American values, because our president of this country may interpret American values a little differently from people sitting in this room. So how then, in this turbulent environment, do we find the space and the energy for the best of the humanitarian impulse to continue to gain government support and the support of populations, which in some cases are turning inward?
Excellent question. Great. Last question right here.
Thanks. I'm Steve Mosley, the president of the United Nations Association here in the National Capital Area. I have two questions, if that's fair. It's the last
that's
question.
Fair. Go ahead.
Okay. One question is to Sam and the representative from MSF to say a little bit more about what you think the one or two things the United Nations itself could do under Mr. Guterres to really make your lives more facilitated to do the work you're doing as NGOs in the field. I hear a lot about that problematic relationship with UN agencies from NGOs where I used to work. The second thing, though, I'd like you as the centerpiece of the stage to say a little bit more about what your hopes and expectations are of this new humanitarian agenda, the collaboration between USAID and CSIS. I think it's a great opportunity, but put it in the context of the question before me. We have an administration who is absolutely, until Nikki Haley's comments from South Sudan, indicated they don't wish to provide any humanitarian assistance or any world food support, although the Senate may force them to do so, thank goodness. Could you comment, though? I'm hopeful that your new agenda will help us all. Thank you.
Sure. No problem. I'll go last. Okay. Why don't you go ahead, Sam?
All right. Populism. there's a clear relationship between the fact that you've got 65 million people moving around the world from poorer places or displaced places, hitting more affluent countries, at a time when this is perceived as a security threat. And that is easy argument to make, that there is an association between the displaced person who looks different is coming in, whether it's taking your job or making you more at risk, and so forth. And we're seeing a rise of that type of nationalism around the world. In many ways, it's interesting within the interaction context, it's led us back to a conversation about values. Who are we and what are we about? Why do we believe that a better interconnected world with different ethnicities working together, that the solutions to humans' problems are ultimately one that will require us to all collaborate in some form or other? Why do we believe that? And can we show evidence that this is what, why, and how we need to act? So I think there's an affirmation of values that comes out to this. The second is then let's play by what's happening around us. This is about security. Your life is less secure if you allow the world to fall apart. And then the question becomes, how do you intervene and what's the nature of that intervention and so forth? Are you doing so? Do you allow space for humanitarian interventions? So in our conversations so far at the White House, we've had candid conversations about international humanitarian law, the space for humanitarian action, and there hasn't been explicit pushback against that. So I think there's some recognition of the humanitarian role that the U.S. must play. But the largest investment of the U.S. government is largely in the development sphere, and there's much less recognition of the role the U.S. could play. And there we end up having divided policy between the administration and Congress, with Congress of both sides of the aisle actually not wanting to have the U.S. pull back. So I think we need to play this on a question of values, but also recognize that the security argument works. What can the UN do? And Antonio Guterres, now I worked with Antonio Guterres for 10 years at the head of UNHCR. He knows the system. He was a member of the Interagency Standing Committee that we sat on. He understands its strengths and weaknesses. The good news is he thinks like a prime minister and a cabinet and wants to make things happen. And he's forced individuals in the UN to come into meetings and know you can't read the notes of where you are as UNHCR versus WFP, but you need to talk and come up with solutions outside your bureaucracy. So he's forcing change on the system, there's no question about that. And he's being very responsive, as are many of the agencies, to pressures from the NGOs for changes as well. And we have to recognize that since we're large and we have many NGOs in the 20, 30, 50,000 people range, that we're part of the system and that we need to recognize our own limits in this. So we are at a time when we probably have some of the best UN leadership in place, with some of the more difficult national leadership in place when the world needs actually more significant change. My hope is that the demands on us as a system are going to force change at a pace that we haven't seen before. And I think under Antonio Secretary Guterres, we will see that type of leadership. Yeah, we're seeing transition at WFP, we'll see transition at UNICEF happening. And these are large bureaucracies that are not going to change easily unless there is some form of significant give and take at the top. And that will require some pressure from donors and others. All this said, without the UN and without the coordination that the UN brings, none of the system would work. There's no way, and we've said this on Congress, that the private donations of the American people would in any way make up for the gap of leadership that's coming from USAID or the UN. We need that infrastructure because it is the sole infrastructure available that the world has to provide some form of effective coordination. And as much as I criticize coordination, it's certainly better than the alternative.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Sam.
Yeah, I think, again, on the issue of the country first, it's making abstraction of what that country's responsibility is. Four out of the five security members of the permanent members of the Security Council are directly involved in one of the biggest refugee-creating crises, by either providing or directly being active in warfare, be it the UK, US, France, they're involved in Syria, in Yemen, directly or indirectly. So when you have that direct implication, that comes with responsibilities. And you can't just say at one point, well, you know, I make abstraction of this, and the reality of these displaces is not my problem. It is the problem of that country. And today, you're looking at the, you know, how Europe and the US are dealing with people that are on the move. A lot of this movement is in large part created in part by their actions, and the total lack of taking responsibility, it pushes people underground. That's what happens. And people will get to Europe, people will get to the US, but off-grid, in a way which is pushing them into criminals' hands. Is that America first, or is that Europe first? You know, in terms of what that's creating, then in terms of being able to access and provide for people in extreme need that then become dependent on a kind of off-grid reality, which is actually extremely worrying. So I think on that side as well, what you have is that you start pushing yourself away from norms. You start pushing yourself away from norms, then the UN has very little that it can actually uphold, because the only kind of strength of the UN is to uphold the mandates, whether it's a refugee mandates, whether it's a human rights mandates, that actually forces organizations signed up to them to act by them. And the more these are pushed aside, the more actually the backbone is no longer there to actually be able to deliver. And that's a very worrying sign. And I agree that hopefully now we've got a realization that these norms need to be upheld and reinforced. So what can the UN do? I mean, also, I'll go back to words. I mean, it's interesting that you talk about humanitarian crisis, or you talk about refugee crisis. Humanitarian crisis was if Sam and I were no longer able to function. That would be a humanitarian crisis, right? A refugee crisis is again, the wrong word. What we're seeing is policy crisis. A policy to actually deal with refugees, which is, as we heard from the Jordanian ambassador, in the single digits, low single digits, if we take them in the US and in Europe, in terms of what impact that would have. You're really talking about an inability of the nations that are very much behind some of the reasons why we're at war today, why these displacements are going on, or why the climate change is creating the kind of movements that we're seeing, that are just unwilling to recognize that it's a policy crisis that they're facing and not living up to their responsibilities. Now, when you look at the UN, I mean, I think the UN on different fronts, on the front of conflicts, we need to be able to have a lot more fact-finding and learning and visibility in terms of what's going on in conflicts. Who's actually bombing, for what reasons? Why are these hospitals being hit? Why are these markets or civilian sites being hit? I mean, it's just too easy today to call this collateral damage or to call this the fog of war. You know, these are being enabled by a lot of armament that's actually coming from the very countries that should be able to uphold their leaders accountable for what's going on. And fact-finding mission without even going to justice, but to be able to actually learn from these in a transparent manner would be just the first step that I think that would help a lot in terms of moving things forward. And actually, it's a step that they've signed up to, but they're not really, hasn't triggered in any way any change so far. Then the next issue is actually to go back to, with the multiple conflicts that we have around the world, to be able to ensure that we've got a space for humanitarian action that's not completely being swallowed up or is the third or fourth priority of the UN in terms of, you know, yes, we need to be able to build peace, yes, we need to be able to protect, but at the same time, we need to be able to save lives today, to let people live in dignity. The 65 million people on the move today need to be able to live in dignity and with the minimum amount of assistance and protection. And that's got to be as much of a priority as actually preventing the next war or this war from being resolved, because these people are in a reality which is just unacceptable. So that space for humanitarian action is going to be important. And then going to a system, and this is less of a, let's say, of our reality in MSF, but you know what's enabled us to act is because we've had the ability to negotiate ourselves, to have, and this is what I was saying earlier, to be able to do our own logistics, to know how to hire a plane and so on. And so to have a system that re-gives responsibility to the field actors and takes away the huge amount of layers and dependencies that's been created in this system today.
Thank you, Jerome. I'll be brief on my response to you. For the humanitarian agenda, the new center-wide initiative that we're launching today. I mean, my hope ultimately is that we strengthen humanitarian assistance, particularly US leadership on that. So there's a couple of ways that we hope to do that. One, we hope to, you know, energize and elevate the importance of humanitarian assistance as a foreign policy priority. And that means working with the international humanitarian community, it means working with the US government, and trying to think through some better policy solutions. Our conversations, our pieces, will help inform and shape US strategies and plans. We're still in the strategy stage right now, but we're gonna be looking at, you know, which issues can we tackle, whether it's very specific geographic or programmatic, or what big issues can we tackle? How can we be most useful? I don't wanna be duplicative. I don't wanna do events to do events. I really wanna do something, and so does USAID, that can be meaningful, but that can bring our thought leadership, our network, you know, the work that we're already doing in this area. There's a lot of CSIS programs that have been touching humanitarian issues and working on this for quite some time, but I want to find a way to sort of leverage that and take it to another level. And so that's my greatest hope. Thank you all for coming today.
Thanks for joining us for another curated conversation from CSIS. Tune in next week for more, and remember, you can explore all of our events online at csis.org.